listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, friends. Ed McGrogan and Steve Tigner return to your podcast. However you choose to listen to it, we are back. Fortnite's worth of hiatus, but it's tough. We've found in the past, I think, to do these pods during a slam when they really age almost as soon as they're published. I think this is a good opportunity, Steve, for us to really kind of reflect on the tournament as a whole. I think it's kind of a good way to do it. And I think the one thing that I take away from this Wimbledon is kind of an uplifting Wimbledon by the end of it. It was, you know, by the first week was made such a mess by the rain. You didn't have Rafa playing. You had it was not really a experience that kind of befitted what you think about when you're watching Wimbledon. I thought that considering that the two champions ended up they had lost both of the other two Grand Slam finals coming into this event, they kind of make amends for that at Wimbledon. I thought overall it was pretty satisfying by the end, certainly for Serena and Andy Murray especially.
Yeah, it was definitely the 2 weeks were completely different. You know, the first week was a disaster with rain, then everything, you know, that was pretty quickly forgotten. In the second week, I think it seemed to really start with Sam Querrey beating Djokovic, and that kind of you know, spurred on the men's side. And like you said, Murray and Serena finishing with wins. You know, I felt like this was a tournament where you could almost see the upside of these players being around for a long time. You really get to know them. Andy Murray, this was the first time we really saw him outside of the Big Four. He didn't have to play any of them in the final. It was just about him and how good he is as a player. You could see that. We had Serena, you know, really just showing again that she, you know, she's not really going to fade away at all. And then I also thought for two other veterans, Venus Williams and Roger Federer, they were also big stories. You know, they didn't win, but just there, where they are and what they mean to fans now and what they were able to do over the 2 weeks, good and bad, you know, I felt like that was a great addition to the tournament, even though they didn't win it.
Yeah, I think we have to kind of touch upon all four of those all those individuals in a little more detail here. And I think let's work our way backwards and start with the last player who was on court and who was the winner. That was Andy Murray. I didn't even realize until now that you mentioned it that he didn't have to play Federer, Nadal, or Djokovic to win a major title. I wonder when the last time that happened was, if any major champion didn't have to beat one of those three guys to win. Has to been a long, long time, I would think. But you know, irrespective of that, I came away from watching Murray, who I actually did pick to win this event. I did sort of think Djokovic might be due for a slip, but we can get to him in a little bit. But Murray impressed me kind of from the start. I thought, as I've said before, he wins Queen's Club. I think those grass events are very strong indicators. They have historically been. He ends up facing the same guy he faced in the final of there, as to kind of hammer that point home a little bit more. But I just came away with this thinking that, you know, I felt good for Murray, who had an incredible 2-8 record in slam finals. He'd obviously faced, or he'd faced only Federer and Djokovic in finals before. And I thought when he, you know, a guy who some people have defended, because he's always straddled this imaginary line of, is he in the same caliber as Federer, Djokovic, Nadal? I've always believed he has been. And I think it was good for probably a relief in a way that when he was expected to win and when he got this great opportunity, I mean, he clearly made the most of it. He had really all the answers for Raonic. The match really was not ever in doubt to me. And then the big thing is, of course, he runs away with the two tiebreakers, where you could certainly make the case that with Raonic's serve, he should have be coming into those with kind of an edge, at least putting a lot more pressure on Murray. But Murray really just locked in from the start, and I think he's in a pretty good place coming out of this.
Yeah, I think the thing to me with Murray is just his consistency was finally rewarded. You know, he's the guy who's been in so many finals, been in the last two, never got a chance to play anybody but Federer or Djokovic, so you never really thought of him as just a champion in his own right. You know, always sort of the second tier of the big four, you know, always the last of the fourth of the big four. You know, there was talk about, obviously this came right after he hired Yvonne Lendl, but I didn't feel like this was, and Murray credited Lendl, but I don't think, I think this was more of a credit to Murray and his overall dominance over these guys outside of the big four. The players he played in the last four rounds, Kyrgios, Tsonga, Berdych, and Raonic, coming into the tournament, he'd won 24 of 25 matches against them. So it wasn't as if this was something new for Murray. This was really just a sort of a validation of what he's been doing for a long time and how good he is. And he, you know, at the end in his press conference, he said, "I feel like that my best days are ahead of me," which may sound impossible at age 29, but you sort of feel like whenever he can get an opportunity like this, and maybe now as a guy who's won Wimbledon twice, he'll feel a little better about playing somebody like Djokovic in the next Wimbledon final. So, you know, like you said, I think that's a, you know, he looks stronger than he ever has.
Yeah, and for, you know, for Murray, the one thing he hasn't done, you know, obviously aside from a couple significant titles, but he's never been to number one in the world, and you kind of wonder where this may take him. If, I mean, it would seem that he has a chance now to kind of make that push to see where it goes, and I think that's a big motivator for him. I think he would at some point in his career love to say that he was ranked number one in the world. That's a long ways away considering where the rankings are. But when you mention Lendl too, it is a thing where you thought that Murray's two prior Grand Slam titles, that Lendl, it seemed that he was such a big reason for that, those coming to light. It was made a lot more of, and you're obviously not going to make, you're obviously the second time around, the impact just by nature is going to be a little bit less, but there has to be something to what Lendl at least provides him, maybe not in a tactical sense, but maybe in a comfort sense. And I mean, a lot of people have written that Murray excelled with Lendl because he felt like he had something to prove to him, not to let him down in his corner. You know, whenever the cameras pan to him, it's just classic Lendl, the appearance, give nothing away. And I guess, you know, there has to be something to him winning his first two tournaments back with him, and doing so really without, you know, with kind of the game that we saw from Murray 3 years ago, when it looked like he was in this position to possibly make a run at number one as well.
Yeah, I think there must be something to it. I think the first time he was with him, it was true that I think Murray wanted to almost not ruin Lendl's reputation in a way. He talked about that a little bit. This time he talked about, I don't think that's true anymore. That type of thing is true anymore. He did talk about this time that Lendl is just a good leader of their group. And I think he, just having a guy who's a winner like that with Murray, maybe gives him a little extra confidence. I still don't think he would have lost any of these matches at Wimbledon without Lendl. But I think he's a good, you know, he is a good guy for Murray. I think he gives a little extra, you know, sort of winning edge, just a little more cockiness almost to Murray, and you know, a necessary cockiness.
Yeah. And I think one thing too for Murray that impressed me, and this also impressed me with Serena, who we should get into now, is that the two losses that he took in Melbourne and in Paris, he did not let those losses linger and really fester into something that kind of took it, you know, made a really negative imprint on his season. And you could say the same for Serena as well. With Serena's losses in Melbourne and Paris, unexpected as they were, they didn't seem to have the singular, just crushing blow that we saw from her in Flushing Meadows the year before. And I think that was, pretty important, I think, to both of them really kind of wiping the slate clean at Wimbledon. And Serena ends up beating Kerber in a great straight set match. It was one of the matches of the tournament, I thought, in terms of just great shot making. And, you know, now she will actually get a kind of a chance at redemption in Flushing Meadows this year, where, you know, she'll be able to actually have a shot at passing Groff at with 23 majors after this Wimbledon win. I also thought now, because of this one win, I actually don't think that the Margaret Court number is impossible any longer, but that's a little far ahead, but I thought it was worth mentioning. But Serena, I think a tournament that she probably also deserved in some ways, considering, you know, how she's continued to put herself in spots this year.
Yeah, at some point it seemed to just click for her in this tournament. I'm not sure exactly what happened. I don't know if she would even know. It seemed like after beating McHale, she had a real, you know, that was a pretty explosive match. She was angry in that match, smashed her racket. Then she was very calm. It started with the match against Kuznetsova. She served better. I felt like both Kuznetsova and Pavlyuchenkova and Kerber all played well against Serena. And if Serena had been in a different mood, she might have really let that bother her. She could have lost those matches, but she kind of took their best, never really looked like she was in trouble, found a way to win, acted as if she was, you know, she was going to win, and she won all of those in straight sets. I think she did have, the way she talked about herself during the tournament, how she said, mentally, no one can break me. I feel like she did want to prove that Vinci match hadn't scarred her, despite these last two losses in the finals. And I also think maybe she found a way to not be so tense about winning everything. She talked about that as well. I don't need to be perfect. That undermines her, what she needs to do. So,
and last year at the Open, she, you know, at that point in the year, she had to be, whether it was, it wasn't her own feelings that she had to be perfect, but just by the nature of the calendar year slam, she had to be perfect to accomplish that. And I think that's what we saw in manifesting itself
there. And I think with her, we still see that it's just a battle of her against herself. Nobody else, Muguruza, Kerber, Vika, they've all come up and been good, but it's still Serena kind of, she's fighting herself and winning that battle because she knows, because she's still the best player. It's just a matter of, you know, whether she can find her best tennis, and that's still the mental battle. And this time she won that.
And she is her toughest opponent, essentially, is I think a way you can say that too. Kerber, I think, comes out of this very, very nicely, very worthy number two at the moment as well. I think the grass does her game. I think it plays well to her game as well. I mean, she won on a lower bouncing court in Melbourne as well. But Kerber's really, you know, I think, proven an all surface player. Really, this year especially, she even did win in Stuttgart on clay two before the French. Didn't have a great result there, of course. But I think she comes out of this looking pretty well, rebounding from what seemed perhaps like, okay, you won the Australian Open and then kind of reverting back to the form. But this is a nice win here. And I think it really all sets up, you know, when you account for Azarenka and Muguruza as well, where all four of those players' games can translate nicely on hard courts for the remainder of the year, I think it sets up a pretty nice summer run for the WTA on hard courts, where you're going to, I think all of those players are going to get shots to, and with the Olympics too as well. I think that's a pretty good way to settle things, I suppose.
Yeah, I think Kerber showed, you know, in a strange way, she's reversed herself from the past few years when she was good at smaller tournaments but not in the big ones. Now she seems to have made herself into a big match, big tournament player. She played with, I think the thing that was most notable this time was how she seemed to convince herself that her best game was to be aggressive. That's not really been her style in the past, but she talked about that through this tournament. She really played that way. She played that way against Halep and Venus and to a certain extent against Serena. I mean, she was fairly even with Serena if you discount the serve. I think she, for some reason, at the end of each set, Kerber kind of rushed and got tight and made a lot of errors. So she didn't really believe she could win that match, I don't think. But yeah, when you see the number two ranking next to her, it doesn't seem strange anymore. It doesn't seem like that's going to go away. You know, we'll see again. But I liked her the way she – I feel like she talked with a little more – she was a little more assertive and confident in the way she talked about it and played, you know, her game in this tournament. I think she made a lot of fans. You know, she's a fun player to watch, and people can see that now.
Yeah, I think she has become sort of a fan favorite in that way. You're right. So Venus and Federer, you mentioned earlier, and before we even started talking, I had grouped them together for kind of the same reasons that you mentioned. They both go to the semis. The next time we see them at a major, Federer will be 35. Venus recently turned 36. You know, the first, you know, one of the things that comes to mind with them right away is, you know, did we just see really the last great chance and last big run of both of these two pass us by? And then the more I just think about it now, and you kind of look at it from the other, you know, the other side, and thinking to what these two actually said in press during Wimbledon, Venus early on had a lot of sort of sage comments about where she is. You know, this, despite her high seeding and her previous history at this event, I was certainly not expecting a semifinal. And I think by the time she'd gotten there, we had almost expected her to win that and play Serena in the final. For Federer, you know, he comes off what I think is a very tough loss to Raonic. I think we'll get into that in a little bit, but he comes away and in his presser once he after his loss to in the semis, you know, it clearly stung him the way it all turned out, but he also said that, you know, he overachieved at this tournament, and that was something that probably shouldn't be sort of overlooked, and considering where he was just a few weeks earlier at the French, or which he didn't play, of course. So maybe what are your kind of thoughts on really this tournament and perhaps, you know, the careers at this point of these two all-time greats?
Yeah, I don't know if Federer really believes he overachieved after losing to Raonic the way he did. But I think it was a great tournament in for both of them in a way. In Federer's case, he had a pretty great win over Cilic, saving match points, a classic tiebreaker. I think he, you know, that will probably be the memory he'll try to take away from the tournament. We'll see if that's his last great win like that. And then the semi, I felt like, you know, in the past we've seen him not be able to sort of have a hiccup against other top players and not look as confident against somebody like Djokovic. That's the way he looked in the fifth set of this match with Raonic, because of the way he lost the fourth set. You know, it's pretty inexplicable how he lost the fourth set. But it did seem...
Yeah, if you had forgotten anybody, Federer holds to... After having a number of break chances against Raonic, really testing his serve for most of this fourth set, Federer up 2-1, he gets to 5-6 and 40-love with the tiebreaker, you know, just seconds away, obviously, and drops his first service point, double faults at 40-15, double faults at 40-30, just back-to-back stuff you just don't see. And from that point on, it was, a, you know, something that Roger wants to forget clearly.
But that reminded me a little of the 2014 Wimbledon final, the way he finished against Djokovic. Suddenly at the end, he just missed four shots on his serve. I felt like there is something about him now in these later stages of the slams that doesn't quite believe the way he used to. He knows he doesn't quite have the edge that he used to. But this was the first time I saw him look that way against somebody like Raonic as opposed to somebody like Djokovic.
Yeah, that is I think pretty telling. I think you're right about that. And oftentimes when Federer maybe took a loss to a player like this, it was earlier in a slam too, or at an event that was not as the stakes weren't as high. You would always figure that the pressure would inevitably shift over to his opponent, and thing I remember or was thinking about as this match unfolded was that this to me felt like the 2009 Open Final when Federer had really at various points seemed to be on the brink of just taking that match from Del Potro, a guy who you could maybe loosely compare to Raonic in terms of how hard they hit the ball, but it, kind of a match that I think Federer will rue when he looks back and kind of senses a missed opportunity. I think this match is one of those, and you really see that it'll be tough to remember it for the Chilich win as much as it will be to remember it for this defeat. I have to say.
Yeah, I guess you could see with Raonic the virtue of getting one of Federer's serve back when you have a big point. Chilich couldn't do that. I think this tournament shows the virtue for Federer of over the years of having gone injury free. Not only did this injury keep him from it forced him to miss some tournaments, but then you also have the ramp up back. He's never had to do that, or at least in the last 10 years or so. He's never had this sort of never had to miss anything for injury, and never had to go into Wimbledon with not being physically sure of himself. For this injury to come at this stage, it's definitely unfortunate. You can see where how much he's benefited from not having to do that over the years.
While we're on the topic of Raonic too, I think it's a good time to mention John McEnroe, who really, on the surface alone, didn't seem to play much of a coaching role. He was never, the time that we saw McEnroe, and this was kind of a controversial element of the tournament as well, was that McEnroe was actually was calling Raonic's matches for ESPN, for the BBC. He did it during the men's final here, and it's a guy who nominally is a coach on his team. And tennis has always had and has really made no secrets in a way about the conflicts of interest that seem to, for whatever reason, really head to the commentary booth most of all. And it definitely stirred a lot of reaction, I thought, from the tennis internet public community, as anything tends to do, but especially this. But it definitely got more widespread attention too, because it just seems so odd that someone who, in whatever role McEnroe played with Raonic, was somehow deemed deemed acceptable for him to be actually calling his match. I think that purely from a biased perspective, I didn't think he was actually that bad on the broadcast. I thought he gave some insight that you probably would only expect to hear from someone who was in the coaching camp of Raonic. I think McEnroe came away probably pretty impressed overall with Raonic top to bottom. But McEnroe didn't take the opportunity to kind of take away from Andy Murray, for example, either, and Federer when they played in the semis. But what did you think about the whole dynamic of McEnroe being allowed to do this, really?
Yeah, my first reaction was I didn't think it would be that big a deal because of the conflicts we've seen in tennis, in the booth in general, that you have people who share an agent, have a commentator who shares an agent with a player commentating on that player, and it just seemed inevitable that these would happen. But the McEnroe, and I agree that McEnroe did have some insight, not anything earth-shattering, but some insight on Raonic, and he was never going to suddenly start bashing Federer or Murray in the final. So, but the more I thought about it, the more I heard from other people, just the fact that you knew that he's Raonic's coach was enough. Just that fact alone made you wonder, what is he not saying? You know, even if he wasn't holding anything back, the fact that you had to wonder that was enough that he should have been kept out of the booth. Just that it was such an obvious,
that you're almost suspending belief for
awkward situation. Yeah, where you think, okay, what is he saying? What he really thinks? Then you shouldn't have to, you know, the audience shouldn't have to wonder about that, and in such an obvious way. So, I think this was a case where, and I think most people at ESPN would probably agree that that was a, and BBC now would agree that that was a mistake, to have him in the booth. And it definitely, he's such a high profile guy that it became much bigger than any of the other conflicts we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I mean, McEnroe is still really, if you want to survey some people on the street and say, you know, name five tennis players, the biggest personalities in tennis, I think McEnroe is still going to be said there, and I think that added to it at all.
Let me just, as far as his coaching goes, does show, you know, I think Raonic did improve with McEnroe there, and there's no way in the month that he was with him that he could have really taught him much, but I think it just shows that the super coach, quote unquote, super coach is a, they have value just in whatever confidence they bring to their player, whatever extra little bit of aggression or that Raonic came up with just having McEnroe there. It's the same with Murray having Lendl, to have one of these sort of icons of the game with them. It has value, you know.
I think that in an individual sport like tennis, where really it's always been all on you, and you're not really answering to a teammate or to really, you know, especially when you're getting into these upper reaches of the game. I mean, there are few personalities that you could be associated with where I think this ties back to maybe where we were with Lendl and Murray years ago, where you do feel like you have something to prove, to live up to. And just the fact that, honestly, I think at the base of it, that someone of John McEnroe's caliber would sees something in Milos Raonic and wants to work with him and sort of inherently believes in what he's doing. I think it's true that the players really do get, you know, they get something out of that. And now we've seen that through, if you go through the top 10, you're seeing, this is almost, it's almost the exception if there hasn't been some type of arrangement. You had Edberg and Federer and Becker and Djokovic, Lendl, you know, McEnroe for a spell here. Carlos Moya also working with Raonic should be said too. But it doesn't seem like this fad or trend. It doesn't seem like a trend at all. It seems like a thing that, and I guess that part of it too is that, you know, these coaches, these legends, who you probably wouldn't think, and they probably don't need the money really to begin with. I mean, I think the thing we're overlooking is these guys clearly just want to be in the game still, in the sport. And I think that holds true for a lot of sports where it's a hard thing for retired players and greats to let go. But man, I mean, I don't know if it's just we're that close to it in tennis, but you can't escape how much these guys and girls don't want to leave the sport.
Yeah, I think Becker, you know, Becker is, and Djokovic is probably the best example of they've had an incredible record together. Whatever you may think Becker actually brings to it, the results have been great, and it's gone on for quite a while. So all of those relationships have you know, helped the players. And yeah, we should mention Moya, because Raonic really, I think he had a surge even right after he hired Moya in Australia at the start of the year. So, you know, that was, you know, that's also the case. And Moya seems more involved in the day-to-day with Raonic than McEnroe is.
Why don't we end this on probably the biggest match of the tournament, the biggest upset of the tournament, because I think it kind of maybe leads into where the rest of this year goes, and that centers around Novak Djokovic, who, as I mentioned earlier, I did think was possibly due for another for a defeat. He wins the French. You know, I know he didn't play any warm-ups. He's done that before at Wimbledon, and he's done extremely well here. But it was a different Djokovic than we'd seen in a long, long time. I have a hard time getting that second set of him and Querrey out of my mind, and just seeing Djokovic practically giving points away to a player who, before that win, would have been one of the last players you would have expected to pull off an
upset. Maybe that's why Djokovic was giving those points away.
Yeah. I mean,
thought he could come back, you know.
Yeah, it was. When the rain came and it ended their match at two sets to love Querrey, I thought of it as like kind of tennis's version of horse in basketball, where you're spotting your lesser opponent, HORS, and seeing if he can actually finish the deal. And I think we ran, I think most of the polls and things seemed to suggest, I don't know what the betting line was, truthfully, it was probably out there, that it was still Djokovic's match to win, really, even in his perilous position. And he ends up taking the third set, and you say, okay, I mean, this is the Sam Querrey we all know and probably don't love, but this is the guy that has really for his whole career just been unable to kind of break through with a signature performance like this. The fourth set of that match was pretty great, I thought. That was really some of the best hours worth of tennis we saw of the tournament. And, you know, Djokovic for once basically, you know, can't get the job done. And, you know, kudos to Sam Querrey. I think you have to tip your cap there.
Yeah, that was, but, you know, Querrey's served incredibly well. I think played with more confidence than we've seen. I think Djokovic, I mean, what, you know, he looked like he was really struggling mentally to get himself into the match. You know, even he hinted maybe at some physical problems afterwards, but I think just like you said, he threw away the second set. Even the second day, he didn't have that automatic sort of sense of fire or that he was really right back into this thing. I think, you know, you look back at after he won in Indian Wells in Miami, he came to Monte Carlo and had a bad tournament. He couldn't really make the transition. He said he was tired. He needed a break. This time he wins in Madrid and then in Paris, a big win in Paris that he'd been in, you know, been looking for a decade. And then he comes to Wimbledon. He does this, has the same sort of reaction. He can't make the transition and sort of looks a little burnout and says he needs a rest. So I feel like that was maybe that win at the French, he just this time he couldn't bounce back quickly. You know, I think it's been the exception to the rule that players will win those two tournaments back to back or bounce back the way he has the last couple of years from losing late at the French to winning Wimbledon. That in a way that's more of an anomaly than what happened this year. And he was going to lose at some point. He won four straight. Serena won four straight last year. Then she lost. He won four straight this year. Then he lost. That's just was going to happen.
All right. And why don't we give equal time and say, you know, not only, you know, kind of a great moment for Sam Querrey, of course, but as you and I have talked about offline a bit, this was a pretty nice American tournament altogether as the tours, you know, make their way back here. Even a guy, you know, Steve Johnson, fourth round, you could kind of go, Coco Vandeweghe had another nice Wimbledon. I think this was another sort of pretty satisfying tournament in a way for a lot of American tennis fans as well. Querrey's, you know, win being the highlight, of course.
Yeah, I think you could say that American tennis is interesting, at least right now. You have you know, Madison Keys did well. Sloan Stevens had a decent run. Query, Johnson, Isner played another epic. You know, there's nobody. Of course, the Williams sisters, can't forget that. And Venus sort of resurgence. It does seem like from top to bottom, especially on the women's side, but also with the men, that there is a sort, you know, there's more players now than there were. That's not the dominant U.S. of last century, but it's almost like they've caught up to sort of France and Spain and other countries that have a lot of top players, have a good quantity, if not the top quality. And I think that's somewhere for the U.S. to build. They had in the round of 16, there were six matches with U.S. players. That was the most of any country. I don't know if that doesn't happen often for the U.S. So I think that was an encouraging tournament.
Yeah, and we'll be seeing plenty more of those, all of those players, even at this week's events. If you were just itching for more, you'll see Steve Johnson top seed in Newport too. So, but you'll be seeing all of those players between the Olympics, events leading up to the Open, etc., as per usual. Let's call it there. This is a pretty good rundown of the championships. Like I said, I thought a pretty enjoyable tournament when it all was said and done here. We will catch up on the podcast as we make our way toward the hardcore tournaments of note. So for Steve Tegner, this is Ed McGrogan. Thank you again for listening to the Tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the Tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to Tennis.com.